days run, to map out their training schedules, and to keep each other motivated. The same with a group of colleagues who have become yoga devotees. They're busy people, but somehow they find the time to meet after work at the same yoga class 5 times a week, and then they get together after class to talk about their lives. We do this because we care about our parents. We're serious about running, and we want to excel at it, and we enjoy the change in our lives that yoga provides, so we can become disciplined at it. That rigor can and should be extended to follow-up in our own lives. After all, isn't changing our behavior and our interpersonal relationships as vital as taking care of our parents or maintaining our physical well-being? Almost anyone in your life can function as your coach. It could be a spouse or a sibling, or a son or daughter, or a colleague or a best friend. It could even be your mother or father. They nagged you when you were a child. I'm sure they'd be delighted to nag you again, only this time with your permission. Your only criteria for picking a coach are, 1. It shouldn't be a chore for your coach to get in touch with you. And with cell phones, that's no longer an issue. You never want to have some technical problem as an excuse for not following up. 2. Your coach should be interested in your life and have your best interests at heart. You don't want someone yawning through your checklist as you answer whether you flossed or remembered to take your vitamins. For example, Jim Moore is an old friend, also from my home state of Kentucky. We enjoy talking to each other. It's not a burden for us to call each other. 3. Your coach can only ask the prescribed questions. He or she cannot judge your answers. Warning, if your coach is a spouse or parent, suspending judgment might be asking a lot of them. After that, it's a simple process. Pick an issue in your life that you're not happy with and that you want to improve. Make a list of a dozen small daily tasks. Nothing so major that it overwhelms the rest of your day, that you need to do to improve in your chosen area. And have your Jim Moore ask you about each task at the end of each day. That's it. As with any exercise, you won't see results immediately. But if you stick to it with daily follow-up, you will do all the tasks on your list. The results will appear. You will change. You will be happier. And people will notice. Chapter 12. Practicing Feed Forward. Here's where we are. You've identified the interpersonal habit that's holding you back. You've apologized for whatever errant behavior has annoyed the people who matter to you, at work or at home. You've said, "I'm sorry, I'll try to do better," and they've accepted that. You've continued to advertise your intention to change your ways. You've remained in steady contact with the people who matter, regularly reminding them that you're trying to do better. You do this by bringing up your objectives and asking point blank, "How am I doing?" You have also mastered the essential skills of listening and thanking. You can now listen to people's answers to your questions without judging, interrupting, disputing, or denying them. You do this by keeping your mouth shut, except to say thank you. You've also learned how to be more diligent about follow-up, seeing the process as part of an ongoing, never-ending advertising campaign to A. find out from others if you are in fact getting better, and B. remind people that you're still trying. Still trying. With these skills, now you're ready for feed forward. As a concept, as something to do, feed forward is so simple, I almost blush to dignify it with a name. Yet some of the simplest ideas are also the most effective. Since they're so easy to do, you have no excuse to not try them. Feed Forward asks you to do 4 simple steps. 1. Pick the one behavior that you would like to change, which would make a significant, positive difference in your life. For example, "I want to be a better listener." 2. Describe this objective in a one-on-one dialogue with anyone you know. It could be your wife, kids, boss, best friend, or coworker. It could even be a stranger. The person you choose is irrelevant. He or she doesn't have to be an expert on the subject. For example, you say, "I want to be a better listener." Almost anyone in an organization knows what this means. You don't have to be an expert on listening to know what good listening means to you. Likewise, he or she doesn't have to be an expert on you. If you've ever found yourself on a long flight seated next to a perfect stranger and proceeded to engage in an earnest, heartfelt, and honest discussion of your problems with the stranger, or vice versa, you know this is true. Some of the truest advice can come from strangers. We are all human beings. We know what is true. And when a useful idea comes along, we don't care who the source is. If you think about it, a stranger, someone who has no past with you and who cannot possibly hold your past failings against you, or for that matter, even bring them up, may be your ideal feed-forward partner. 3. Ask that person for 2 suggestions for the future that might help you achieve a positive change in your selected behavior. In this case, becoming a better listener. If you're talking to someone who knows you or who has worked with you in the past, the only ground rule is that there can be no mention of the past. Everything is about the future. For example, you say, "I want to be a better listener. Would you suggest 2 ideas that I can implement in the future that will help me become a better listener?" The other person suggests, "First, focus all your attention on the other person. Get in a physical position, the listening position, such as sitting on the edge of your seat or leaning forward toward the individual. Second, don't interrupt, no matter how much you disagree with what you're hearing." These 2 ideas represent feed forward. 4. Listen attentively to the suggestions. Take notes if you like. Your only ground rule, you are not allowed to judge, rate, or critique that suggestion in any way. You can't even say something positive, such as, "That's a good idea." The only response you're permitted is, "Thank you." That's it. Ask for 2 ideas. Listen, say thank you. Then repeat the process with someone else. In seeking feed-forward ideas, you're not limited to one person. That would be like restricting your initial feedback, the one that told you where you needed to improve, to talking to one person. It would dramatically lessen the chances of getting an accurate picture of what you're doing wrong. You can do feed-forward with as many people as you like. As long as the people are providing you with good ideas that you can use or discard, but which don't confuse you, feed-forward is a process that never needs to stop. All I've outlined here, really, are the ground rules for a conversation that should and could take place in the workplace all day long, every day. These conversations rarely happen, precisely because in most workplace conversations, we aren't working with these restrictions. Ask for 2 ideas, listen, say thank you. Even if we behave within the normal parameters of politeness and etiquette in the workplace, we think we have an obligation to be totally honest in every discussion. For some reason, when we're engaged in frank talk with another person, we interpret this to mean that we are locked in a debate. Because we like to succeed, we assume we have to win the debate. We think we have a license to use every debating trick to win, including bringing up the past to bolster our side of the argument. Is it any wonder that even in the least toxic environments, honest, well-intentioned dialogues devolve into hurt feelings, misunderstandings, and counterproductive resentments? Feed forward solves this dilemma. In my scheme of things, feed forward is a dramatic improvement on what we traditionally think of as feedback. It grew out of a discussion I had with John Katzenbach in the early 1990s. We were frustrated with the limitations of the usual corporate feedback mechanisms to find out areas of improvement in an organization, such as the questionnaires that forced people to relive the past over and over again, the discussions among colleagues that descended into nightmarish arguments about who did what to whom way back when. As I hope I made clear in my brief history of feedback in Chapter 6, feedback has its virtues. It's a great tool for determining what happened in the past and what's going on in an organization. It's no different than reading history, which teaches us how we all arrived here right now in this moment. Like reading history, it provides us with facts about the past, but not necessarily ideas for the future. Feed forward, on the other hand, is feedback going in the opposite direction. That is, if feedback, both positive and negative, reports on how you functioned in the past, then feed forward comes in the form of ideas that you can put into practice in the future. If feedback is past tense, then feed forward is future perfect. The best thing about feed-forward is that it overcomes the 2 biggest obstacles we face with negative feedback. The fact that successful people in dominant positions don't want to hear it, no matter what they say, bosses prefer praise to criticism, and that their subordinates rarely want to give it. Criticizing the boss, no matter how ardently he or she tells you to bring it on, is rarely a great career move. Feed Forward shrinks the discussion down to the intimate parameters of two human beings. If it isn't obvious yet, and if it isn't, then one of us has not been paying attention. This book and its process for getting better hinges on one inalterable concept. I don't establish what you need to change for the better. You don't establish it either. They do. Who are they? Everyone around you. Everyone who knows you, cares about you, thinks about you, has you pegged. Let's say you want to do a better job of listening. It's possible that a coach can explain to you how to be a better listener. The advice will be true, supportable, and impossible to dispute, but it will be generic. It's much better to ask the people around you, "What are some ways I can do a better job of listening to you?" They'll give you specific, concrete ideas that relate to them, how they perceive you as a listener, not the vague ideas a coach would give. They may not be experts on the topic of listening, but at that moment in time, they actually know more about how you listen or don't than anyone else in the world. Until you get everyone who is affected by your behavior on your side and working to help you change, you haven't really begun to get better. This is why the concept of feed forward is so important. Feed forward eliminates many of the obstacles that traditional feedback has created. It works because, while they don't particularly like hearing criticism, i.e. negative feedback, successful people love getting ideas for the future. If changing a certain type of behavior is important to them, they will gobble up any ideas that are aimed at changing that behavior, and they will be grateful to anyone who steps forward with an idea, not resentful. There's no arguing with this. Successful people have a high need for self-determination and will tend to accept ideas about concerns that they own while rejecting ideas that feel forced upon them. It works because we can change the future, but not the past. It doesn't deal in wishes, dreams, and conquering the impossible. It works because helping people be right is more productive than proving them wrong. Unlike feedback, which often introduces a discussion of mistakes and shortfalls, feed forward focuses on solutions, not problems. On the most elemental level, it works because people do not take feed forward as personally as feedback. Feed forward is not seen as an insult or a put-down. It is hard to get offended about a suggestion aimed at helping us get better at what we want to improve, especially if we are not forced to implement the suggestion. On a purely technical level, it works because when we receive feed forward, all we have to do is function as a listener. We can focus on hearing without having to worry about responding. When all you're allowed to say is thank you, you don't have to worry about composing a clever response. You are also not permitted to interrupt, which makes you a more patient listener. Practicing feed forward makes us shut up and listen while others are speaking. However, feed forward is a two-way street, and it is designed to protect as well as bring out the best in the people who are providing it. After all, who among us doesn't enjoy giving helpful suggestions when asked? The key is when asked. Feed forward forces us to ask, and in doing so, we enlarge our universe of people with useful ideas. Asking, of course, gives the other person a license to answer. I cannot overestimate how valuable this license can be. I'm sure that all of us are surrounded by smart, well-meaning friends who understand us better than we understand ourselves. I suspect that they would love to help us. Most people like to help others. But they would hold back because they think it is rude or intrusive to try to help someone who has not asked for assistance. Asking solves this. Also, there's no threat of pain in the process. If you're giving me two ideas that I've asked for, you will only receive my gratitude, not resentment. Not an argument, not punishment. On top of that, you don't even have to be right. You don't have to prove that your suggestions are good ideas, because I'm not judging them. All I can do is accept them or ignore them. A clever scheme that eliminates fear and defensiveness, don't you think? More than anything, feed forward creates the two-way traffic I love to see in the workplace. The spirit of two colleagues helping each other, rather than a superior being providing or critique. It's the feeling that when we help another person, we help ourselves. Leave it at the stream. If feed forward sounds like some eating technique you've seen advertised on late night TV, guaranteeing weight loss with a faster metabolism, I apologize. Feed forward won't make you thinner. but it may make you happier. The concept really is as simple as it sounds. Instead of rehashing a past that cannot be changed, Feed Forward encourages you to spend time creating a future by A. asking for suggestions for the future, B. listening to ideas, and C. just saying thank you. Its strongest element, by far, is that it doesn't permit you to bring up the past, ever. It forces you to let go of the past. That's important when you consider how many hours of organizational time and productivity are lost in an endless retelling of our coworkers' blunders, or how much internal stress we generate reliving real or imagined slights, or how often team-building sessions degenerate into, "Let me tell you what you did wrong, slugfests," rather than, "Let me ask you what we can do better, lovins." An old Buddhist parable illustrates the challenge and the value of letting go of the past. Two monks were strolling by a stream on their way home to the monastery. They were startled by the sound of a young woman in a bridal gown, sitting by the stream, crying softly. Tears rolled down her cheek as she gazed across the water. She needed to cross to get to her wedding, but she was fearful that doing so might ruin her beautiful handmade gown. In this particular sect, monks were prohibited from touching women, but one monk was filled with compassion for the bride. Ignoring the sanction, he hoisted the woman on her shoulders and carried her across the stream, assisting her journey and saving her gown. She smiled and bowed with gratitude as the monk splashed his way back across the stream to rejoin his companion. The second monk was livid. "How could you do that?" he scolded. "You know we are forbidden to touch a woman, much less pick one up and carry her around." The offending monk listened in silence to a stern lecture that lasted all the way back to the monastery. His mind wandered as he felt the warm sunshine and listened to the singing birds. After returning to the monastery, he fell asleep for a few hours. He was jostled and awakened in the middle of the night by his fellow monk. "How could you carry that woman?" his agitated friend cried out. "Someone else could have helped her across the stream. You were a bad monk." "What woman?" the sleepy monk inquired. "Don't you even remember? That woman you carried across the stream," her colleague snapped. "Oh, her," laughed the sleepy monk. "I only carried her across the stream. You carried her all the way back to the monastery." The learning point is simple. When it comes to our flawed past, leave it at the stream. I am not suggesting that we should always let go of the past. You need feedback to scour the past and identify room for improvement. But you can't change the past. To change, you need to be sharing ideas for the future. Race car drivers are taught, look at the road, not the wall. That's what Feed Forward does. Who knows? Not only may it help you win the race, but you'll definitely have a better trip around the track. Section 4, Pulling Out the Stops, in which leaders learn how to apply the rules of change and what to stop doing now. Chapter 13, Changing the Rules. If I had to rank my best clients in terms of magnitude of improvement in the shortest amount of time, it would have to be the division chief at a major manufacturing company. Let's call him Harlan. Harlan had 40,000 employees under his control, and he was doing a great job within this enormous division. Harlan was considered a great leader by his direct reports. Harlan's boss, the CEO, desperately wanted him to focus more on reaching out across the organization and providing leadership for the entire company. I went through the drill with Harlan. Commit to changing. Apologize to all the people who gave you feedback. Tell them you're trying to change, and follow up with them regularly to find out how you're doing in their eyes. When I say Harlan's my best client, one of the things I remember is how quickly he got it. He bought my methods lock, stock, and barrel, and put them into action immediately. I was thinking this would be the standard 18-month assignment, but after 12 months, Harlan's feedback was already posting the biggest improvement scores I'd ever seen in the shortest amount of time. I flew to Harlan's headquarters, strolled into his office, and said, "We're done. You have the biggest scores I've ever seen." "What do you mean? We barely got started." "Well, I spent a lot of time with your colleagues assembling the feedback. Let's not forget that. And yes, our time together was brief. But these scores prove that any issues you had with your colleagues last year have evaporated. You see, they see you as being incredibly inclusive and working to benefit the entire company. Don't forget, you're earning several million dollars a year. Your time is valuable, more valuable than mine. Where do you think your CEO would rather have you spending your valuable time? Making money for the company or shooting the breeze with me? I think we know the answer to that one. I'm not in the time-spending business. I'm in the getting better business, and you're better. Harlan conceded the point. I was feeling pleased with myself, about two ticks short of smug if you want the truth, so I opted to waste some of his valuable time to ask, "What do you think you've learned from this whole process?" He surprised me with his answer. "I've learned that the key to your job, Marshall, is client selection. You qualify your clients to the point where you almost can't fail. The deck is totally stacked in your favor." It surprised me, because he wasn't talking about himself. He was turning the tables on me. Then he said something more profound. "I admire that kind of selectivity, because that's what I do here. If I have the right people around me, I'm fine. But if I have the wrong people, not even God can win that hand." I guess that's another reason Harlan is a great client. He saw through all the bells and whistles of my admittedly simple methodology and honed in on my little secret. I make it easy on myself. I don't play sucker bets. I only work with clients who have an extremely high potential of succeeding. Why would anyone want to operate any other way? Jack Welch once told Esquire magazine what he had learned playing sandlot baseball as a kid. He said, "When you were small, you were always the last one picked for the team and put out in right field. The years passed, and then you were putting guys out in right field. You learned one thing as you got older. You picked the best players, and you won." As you go through life contemplating the mechanics of success and wondering why some people are successful and others are not, you'll find that this is one of the defining traits of habitual winners. They stack the deck in their favor, and they're unabashed about it. They do this when they hire the best candidates for a job, rather than settle for an almost the best type. They do this when they pay whatever it takes to retain a valuable employee, rather than lose him or her to the competition. They do this when they're fully prepared for a negotiation, rather than winging it. If you study successful people, you'll discover that their stories are not so much about overcoming enormous obstacles and handicaps, but rather about avoiding high-risk, low-reward situations and doing everything in their power to increase the odds in their favor. For example, have you ever wondered why the most successful people at the top of your organization tend to have the best personal assistants? Simple answer. Successful executives know that a great assistant can shield them from dozens of daily annoyances that would otherwise distract them from doing their real job. If you think all the top executives have top assistants because of their luck rather than design, you need a few more lessons in stacking the deck in your favor. This winning strategy is so obvious to successful people, I almost feel sheepish mentioning it, as if it will elicit a chorus of duhs from readers. But it's amazing how people go out of their way to unstack the deck against themselves. When you're talking about interpersonal behavior, people's common sense gets fuzzy and opaque. They lose sight of their true mission in life. They have trouble identifying or accepting the behavior that's holding them back. They don't know how to choose a strategy to fix the problem, and they often pick the wrong thing to fix. In other words, they stack the deck against themselves. The following 7 rules will help you get a better handle on the process of change. If you obey them, you'll be stacking the deck in your favor. Rule 1. You might not have a disease that behavioral change can cure. I was asked to coach the CEO of a top medical company some years ago. His feedback report was quite a remarkable document. His peers and direct reports genuinely loved this fellow. No one who came in contact with him had anything negative to say about him. I had never seen such perfect marks in interpersonal relations. "What's going on?" I asked. "Why am I here?" The CEO said he felt completely at sea about the technological innovations that were changing the company, and as a result had trouble communicating with some subordinates. "You're a great guy," I said. "I'd love to work with you. But you don't have a disease that I can cure. What you need is a technology wizard to sit by your side and mentor you. You don't need me." He was a little like a hypochondriac with a pain in his ribcage. He thinks he has lung cancer when all he has is a little muscle pull. Sometimes we confuse interpersonal problems with something else. In the medical company case, it was obvious. But the line between a behavioral flaw and a technical shortcoming can get blurry. I was called in to work with the CFO of a major investment bank. Let's call him David. This fellow was an interesting case, a young, ambitious, hardworking, motivated, hit-the-numbers type who was not an arrogant, know-it-all jerk. In fact, David was admired and beloved. In the poker game of life, David had drawn 4 aces and a 9. He wasn't perfect, but damn close. You could see this in the way people in the office related to him. The females swooned over him. The direct reports snapped to attention. His colleagues from other divisions felt comfortable enough around him to engage in the friendly towel-snapping banter you see among ex-jocks who genuinely like and would kill for each other. David seemed to work in a perfect world where everything fell into place the moment he walked into the room. I thought, why am I here? When I studied David's feedback, a disorienting picture emerged. No significant problems on any of the usual interpersonal flaws. Except the consensus opinion was that David could be a better listener. He wasn't hearing them out, and he didn't seem to understand their true accomplishments. This didn't jibe with all of David's positives. Executives who share, inspire loyalty, and are well-liked don't score low on listening. It's an integral part of their interpersonal portfolio. When I dug deeper, though, a more complicated picture emerged. It turned out that David, as CFO, was the firm's front man with the media. Every quarter, he had to talk with analysts and the financial press to highlight the firm's achievements. The firm had fallen prey to the same ethical lapses that many financial services companies were guilty of in the early part of the new millennium. But whereas other firms were getting decent press treatment under the circumstances, David's firm was getting mauled. Every day was a new headline that damaged the firm's reputation, and David took the heat for it. David's people wondered why he wasn't getting the message out properly. We're great, they thought. We're not getting recognized for our greatness. David's in charge of delivering that message to the public and failing at it. Therefore, David's not hearing us. A logical train of thought if you're the direct reports, but not if you're David. David's problem wasn't that he ignored what people told him. As CFO, he knew the results better than anyone. David's problem was that he wasn't very good at spinning the media. That's not a behavioral problem. It's a skill problem. David needed a coach, all right, a media coach, but he didn't need me. You have to be careful with feedback. Conducted properly, feedback is not deceptive. It reveals what's on people's minds, but it can be misinterpreted. You see only what you want to see. Or misread. You see something that isn't there. Keep this in mind. Sometimes feedback reveals a symptom, not a disease. A symptom is a headache. Give it time and it goes away. A brain tumor, on the other hand, can't be ignored. It needs treatment. I see this in organizations that have endured a temporary downturn. The feedback reveals angry employees lashing out at scapegoats. Angry employees need to be heard and dealt with. Sometimes, as in David's case, feedback reveals a problem that's one or two steps removed from anything that the individual is doing wrong. Be careful then. You may be trying to fix something that isn't broken, doesn't need fixing, or can't be fixed by you. Rule 2. Pick the right thing to change. One of the first things I have to face with clients is the difference between miswanting and mischoosing. It's subtle, but real. Wanting, after all, is different from choosing. So are those moments when we get either process wrong, when we miswant or mischoose. The distinction comes from psychologists studying the science of shopping. We want a sweater, for example. Then we choose a certain sweater based on the thought matrix that went into wanting it. For example, there are all sorts of reasons people might want a certain sweater. They might want it for warmth. They might want it for feel. They might want one that looks great, or is reputedly the best in the world, or the most expensive, or cheapest, or the most au courant in style, or that complements the color of their eyes. The reasons for wanting a sweater are almost infinite. Basically, we want a sweater because we think it will make us happier. Miswanting occurs when we discover that what we wanted did not make us happy. Choosing is slightly different. Once we decide what sweater we want, we must choose among a vast array of options that fit the bill. Will it be the blue cashmere sweater with the Armani label and a $1,000 price tag, or the blue wool from Land's End for $49? Both will keep us warm and accent our eye color, if that's what we wanted. But if we're on a limited budget, the latter is a wiser choice than the former. The same distinction arises with people deciding to change for the better. One of my first tasks is helping them distinguish between what they want in life and how they choose to reach that goal. Again, the difference is one of wanting and choosing, and I don't get involved in the wanting part. It's none of my business. To weigh in with an opinion on some individual's goal in life would mean passing a value judgment on his or her reason for living. I won't do that. And in turn, I wouldn't want them passing judgment on my goals. That's what I mean by being mission neutral. However, I do have strong opinions about how people choose to reach their goals. There, I'm not neutral. After all, if they make the wrong choice, they'll fail, which means I'm a failure too, and that is decidedly not my mission in life. See above. So I spend serious time with people helping them decide what they need to change. The first thing we do is review what they're doing right and what they may need to change. Successful people, by definition, are doing a lot of things right, nothing to fix there. Then we narrow it down. Not every challenge needs to be addressed. Assuming that I have gotten an individual to commit to changing for the better and changing something, I often have a hard time convincing successful people that not everything needs improving. Successful people have a glaring tendency to overcommit. If you outline 7 flaws, they'll want to tackle all of them. It's the reason they're successful, and the impetus behind the cliche, if you want something done right, give it to a busy person. So my first task is to tell them, don't overcommit, and get them to believe it. I also know that giving people unlimited choices only confuses them. Faced with too many options, they go back and forth among the options, trying to maximize their choice. Successful people hate being wrong even more than they like being right. This can easily turn into paralysis. In their never-ending quest for the best option, they end up deciding nothing. So I turn their attention to one vital flaw that needs fixing. In most instances, I treat it as a pure numbers game. Let's say you come to me for coaching. We go through your menu of 5 documented areas for improvement. 10% of your coworkers say you don't listen. 10% say you don't share information. 20% say you're bad at meeting deadlines. 40% say you gossip too much. And 80% say you get angry. Which single issue should we focus on changing? Objectively speaking, it's a no-brainer. You have a serious issue with anger. 4 out of 5 coworkers think you have a temper. We need to change that first. You'd think that would be obvious. What's interesting, though, is how often the people I work with try to ignore that in-your-face problem and instead tackle one of the other flaws. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's denial. Although at this point in the process where you're committed to changing, denial should be long behind us. Maybe it's our natural urge to take the path of least resistance, to start with an easy fix first. Maybe it's just contrariness. Whatever the reasons, my job as a coach is to make sure you see that you have to improve at controlling your emotions. The other issues are moot, off the radar. More than half of your colleagues didn't even mention them as an issue. That's how you pick the right thing to change. In a way, I can see why people have problems choosing what needs fixing. In golf, for example, it is common wisdom that 70% of all shots take place within 100 yards of the pin. It's called the short game, and it involves pitching, chipping, hitting out of sand traps, and putting. If you want to lower your score, focus on fixing your short game. It represents at least 70% of your score. Yet if you go to a golf course, you'll see very few people practicing their short game. They're all at the driving range trying to hit their oversized drivers as far as they can. Statistically, it doesn't make sense because over the course of 18 holes, they'll only need their drivers 14 times at most, whereas they'll pull out their short irons and putters at least 50 times. Athletically, it doesn't make much sense either. The short game depends on compact, delicate, small muscle movements. It is much easier to master the violent, big muscle movements of driving off the tee, nor does it make sense competitively. If you improve your short game, you will shoot lower scores and beat the competition. The numbers don't lie, and even the most avid golfers hide from the truth and refuse to fix what really needs fixing. My hunch is that hitting balls out of sand traps all day is simply not as much fun as taking big swipes at the ball off the tee. But who am I to judge? If golfers really wanted to stack the deck in their favor, they'd spend 3 hours on their short game for every hour they spend trying to hit the ball a mile. Still few do. It would take a stern golf teacher standing over them every day to enforce the practice routines they know they should be pursuing. If you think it's hard to get people to fix their flaws in golf, which, let's not forget, is a highly pleasurable game totally within our control, imagine how tough it is getting people to change at work, where the stakes are higher, but the results are not completely under your control. That's one reason I take this stuff so seriously. When people commit to getting better, they are doing something difficult and heroic. In truth, I applaud my clients when they begin the process of fixing their flaws. Not at the end. If they commit and follow my advice, their success is a foregone conclusion. I don't need to applaud a fait accompli. Rule 3. Don't delude yourself about what you really must change. I was called in to work with a chief financial officer named Matt. The problem, as usual, revolved around Matt's interpersonal skills. Nothing wrong with his CFO skills. Matt could read a balance sheet, outmuscle bankers, and keep his company financially viable with the best of them. In fact, as the fellow guarding the company's cash flow, Matt had accumulated more power than any CFO in the company's history. If you wanted to pursue any idea that cost money, you had to run it up the flagpole in Matt's office. Matt, almost as much as the CEO, could bless or kill any initiative. That was the problem. Matt had developed an overweening sense of self-importance. It came out in brusque comments, dismissive opinions, and an increased inaccessibility to his direct reports. That's when I showed up. "Matt, we need to make changes," I said. Matt cut me off. "What I'd really like to do is lose 20 pounds and firm up my body." "Are you serious?" I asked, thinking I'd get some resistance to changing his executive style, but not expecting a discussion about physical fitness. "Yes," he said, dead serious. "You'd rather get a six-pack than get better at work?" I asked. "That's what makes me unhappy," he said, "and that's why I'm so grouchy. If I can fix that, maybe everything else will improve too." I had to admire his honesty, if not his logic. It fit with his feedback, which said he was self-involved to the point of vanity. He thought he knew all the answers. That's what he needed to change. At the same time, I knew the old saw, that if you don't have your health, nothing else matters. So maybe Matt was right. Maybe if he felt better about his looks, his health, and his vigor, everything else would fall into place. So I went with it. I said, "Look, it says here you need to be more sensitive to other people, less abrupt, less self-absorbed. On the other hand, you're so into yourself, you want to fix your stomach muscles. Which do you think is easier to accomplish, a six-pack or one less interpersonal flaw at work?" "A six-pack," he said. "It's just a matter of discipline, following a routine and sticking with it." I thought. "Can't argue with that. If you follow a routine and stick with it, you'll get results. You'll achieve your goals. Only problem, it's very tough to do, even tougher to maintain." But Matt wasn't seeing that. I've spent 3,000 nights in the last 2 decades in hotel rooms, jet-lagged, and wide awake with only the television to keep me company. In other words, I have seen my share of late-night infomercials hawking the latest fitness gadgets. I know all the hard-sell promises. "How much would you pay to have a body like this? In 1 week, you could be feeling great. It feels terrific. Let us show you how easy it is. In 8 minutes a day, tighten your flabby abs into the sexy six-pack you always wanted." I knew why Matt thought acquiring a bodybuilder's abs was easier to achieve than being a little more civil to his colleagues. His mind had been warped by the constant media promises that anyone can get in world-class physical shape without a little effort and willpower. I wasn't questioning Matt's goal. I was worried about his understanding of how we set and achieve goals and why. I've studied the research on goal setting and goal achievement. A lot of it centers on diet and fitness because A, there's a huge population of people interested in such goals, B, it's easy to measure, and C, with record numbers of Americans either obese or out of shape, there's a huge and compelling history of failure in this area. I've learned that there are five reasons people do not succeed with their diet and fitness goals. They mistakenly estimate time. It takes a lot longer than they expected. They don't have to do it. They mistakenly estimate effort. It's harder than they expected. It's not worth all the effort. They mistakenly estimate distractions. They do not expect a crisis to emerge that will prevent them from staying with the program. They mistakenly estimate rewards. After they see some improvement, they don't get the response from others that they expected. People don't immediately love the new improved person they've become. They mistakenly estimate maintenance. Once they hit their goal, people forget how hard it is to stay in shape. Not expecting they'll have to stick with the program for life, they slowly backslide or give up completely. This is what I explained to Matt in his office. I wasn't trying to talk him out of his six-pack. If it makes him happy, I'm cool with it. I was trying to make him see that he was a little delusional about his goal. Getting in shape was eminently doable. Lots of people have done it, but it would not be easy. For one thing, it would take time away from his job. It would probably take more effort than all those infomercials, exercise books, and personal trainers at the gym suggested. There was a good chance that some distractions at a super busy CFO job or at home might sidetrack him. More important, even if he achieved his goal, there was no guaranteed payoff that it would make him less grouchy. On the contrary, it might make him even more vain, self-satisfied, and insufferable. And there was certainly no guarantee that his colleagues would suddenly admire him for his newfound physique. They might even resent it. I could see this last point got to Matt. He was already in a hole with his colleagues. It never occurred to him that some private effort to look and feel better could somehow backfire and put him in a deeper hole with those same colleagues. But it could, because it loudly and specifically excluded them. It was just another example of Matt being self-involved. Even though I didn't walk into Matt's office expecting to talk about abs and crunches, the meeting had a serendipitous benefit, because the reasons we miscalculate our diet and health goals apply to any goal achievement. If you want to succeed at goal setting, you have to face the reality of the effort and the payoff before you begin. Realize that the quick fix and the easy solution may not provide the lasting fix and the meaningful solution. Lasting goal achievement requires lots of time, hard work, personal sacrifice, ongoing effort, and dedication to a process that is maintained over years. And even if you can pull that off, the rewards might not be all that you expect. This may not be the best support for a late-night infomercial, but it is great material for achieving any change. Now, I asked Matt, are we ready to talk about what your colleagues think of you? Rule 4. Don't hide from the truth you need to hear. I am in my late 50s. At my age, the most important feedback I need is called an annual physical examination. As feedback, it's literally life or death information. I managed to avoid this feedback for 7 years. It's not easy to avoid a doctor's visit for 7 years, but I did it by telling myself, I will get a physical after I go on my healthy foods diet. I will get the exam after I begin my exercise program. I will get that exam after I get in shape. Who was I kidding? The doctor? My family? Myself? Have you ever avoided a physical exam and told yourself the same thing? Almost half the executives I've worked with have. How about the trip to the dentist? After putting off the appointment as long as possible, do you orchestrate a frenzy of dental flossing 2 days before visiting the dentist's office? Admittedly, a little bit of impulse behind this behavior is our need to achieve. We want to score well in the doctor's or dentist's test, so we prepare for it. However, a much bigger reason for this behavior is our need to hide from the truth, often from what we already know. We know we need to visit a doctor or a dentist, but we don't because we might not want to hear what he has to say. We figure if we don't seek out bad news about our health or teeth, there can't be any bad news. We do the same in our personal life. For example, when I'm working in a large sales organization, I always throw a spot quiz at the sales force. Does your company teach you how to ask customers for feedback? A chorus of yeses. Does it work? Does it teach you where you need improvement? Another yes chorus. Then I focus on the men. How many times do you do this at home? That is, ask your wife, what can I do to be a better partner? No yes chorus, just silence. Do you men believe this stuff? I ask. Back to the yes chorus. Of course, they say in unison. Well, I presume your wife is more important to you than your customers, right? They nod. So why don't you do it at home? I can see their collective wheels turning as the truth dawns on them. They're afraid of the answers. It might hit too close to home, and worse, then they'd have to do something about it. We do the same with the truth about our interpersonal flaws. We figure if we don't ask for critiques of our behavior, then no one has anything critical to say. This thinking defies logic. It has to stop. You are better off finding out the truth than being in denial. Rule 5. There is no ideal behavior. Benchmarking. The notion that there is a performance ideal exemplified by people and organizations is one of the biggest hazards in getting people to change for the better. It's not that there isn't something to be gained from modeling ourselves against the best in their category, but it can do more harm than good if applied poorly. Sometimes the desire for perfect can drive away better. In my line of work, there are a lot of benchmarks for successful behavior, but they are composites. They are usually made from multiple people and multiple examples. The perfect benchmark human being, like the perfect benchmark organization, does not exist. That colors how people think. They believe that there is an ideal executive out there, and that they should be like him or her. You can't be and don't have to be all things to all people. If there were a list of 39 successful attributes for the model executive, I would never argue that you have to be the perfect expression of all 39 of them. All you need are a few of them. No matter how many of the 39 attributes you don't embody, the real question is, how bad is the problem? Is it bad enough that it merits fixing? If not, don't worry about it. You're doing fine. I take great comfort in the fact that Michael Jordan, to many the best basketball player to ever play the game, was a mediocre baseball player in the minor leagues, and, as a golfer, would have a tough time keeping up with at least 20 golfers who live within an 800-yard radius of my home in San Diego. If Michael Jordan, a preternaturally superb athlete and competitor, in fact, the benchmark for other basketball players, could only excel at one sport, what makes you think you can do better? It's not just sports. I work with a lot of clients in the financial services sector. When I check the annual rankings of how firms are doing against their rivals, one firm is ranked number one at investment banking. A different firm is number one at mergers and acquisitions. Yet another is number one at fixed income securities, and so on through a dozen categories. No firm is number one at everything, and very few firms are even tops in two categories. In an environment where all the big firms are loaded with the best and brightest out of the top business schools, the competition is too stiff for one firm to dominate all the categories. It's no different in the workplace. Take a look around your office. Someone's the best salesman. Someone else is the best accountant. Someone else is the best manager. No one is best at everything. This isn't a license for mediocrity. It's a reality check. It's your permission to deal in trade-offs and pick one thing to improve upon rather than everything. Even in my narrow profession of executive coaching, I've further narrowed my ambition to one thing: helping people achieve long-term positive behavioral change. I don't do strategy. I don't do innovation. I don't coach information technology or media relations or industrial psychology. The list of what I don't do could fill several dozen books. I can live with that because I've chosen to try to be the best I can be in my admittedly narrow corner of the coaching fiefdom. If I'm shooting for gold at this, I have to come to terms with the fact that I ain't even stepping up to the starting blocks in everything else. The same applies to your task of changing your behavior. Pick one issue that matters and attack it until it doesn't matter anymore. If you're a bad listener, choose to become a better listener, not the best listener in the world, whatever that means. If you don't share information, get better at sharing until it's not an issue anymore. But realize that you will never be perfect in everyone's eyes, and you don't need to be. Benchmarking is great because it teaches us to aim high, but when we apply it to ourselves, we often overreach. This is the ready, fire, aim school of self-improvement. We don't discriminate among benchmarks. We want to be the best at everything. When it comes to creating long-term positive change in ourselves, we have one gun, one bullet. You can't hit more than one target with that ammunition. P.S. There's a bonus to ignoring benchmarks. People commonly fear if they get better at X, they'll get worse at Y, as if improvement is a zero-sum game. Not true. Statistically, if you get better at X, it helps everything else get better too. I have 20,000 feedback reports confirming this. If you're a bad listener who learns to listen more, then you are perceived as treating people with more respect. In deferring to their views, you probably hear their ideas better. Good ideas don't fall through the cracks because of your benign neglect. This in turn makes you appear as a more involved, concerned leader, which improves your morale and surely has an effect on delivering better numbers. Everything gets better with one change. That's a statistical fact. Rule 6. If you can measure it, you can achieve it. Most of us in business spend a great deal of time measuring. We measure sales, profits, rate of growth, return on investment, income versus outgo, same-store sales from quarter to quarter, etc. In many ways, part of being an effective manager and leader is setting up systems to measure everything. It's the only way we know for sure how we're doing. Given our addiction to measurement and its documented value, you'd think we'd be more attuned to measuring the soft side values in the workplace. How often we're rude to people. How often we're polite. How often we ask for input in a meeting rather than shut people out. How often we bite our tongue rather than spit out a needlessly inflammatory remark. These are the soft values that are hard to quantify, but, in the area of interpersonal performance, are as vital as any hard number we can come up with. They demand our attention if we want to alter our behavior and get credit for it. About 10 years ago, I decided I wanted to be a more attentive father. So I asked my daughter, "What can I do to be a better parent?" She said, "Daddy, you travel a lot, but I don't mind that you're away from home so much. What really bothers me is the way you act when you are home. You talk on the telephone, you watch sports on TV, and you don't spend much time with me." One weekend, when you'd been traveling for 2 weeks, my friends were having a party. I wanted to go, but Mom wouldn't let me. She said I had to spend time with you. So I stayed home, but you didn't spend any time with me. That wasn't right. I was hurt and stunned because A, she nailed me, and B, I was an oafish dad who had needlessly caused his daughter pain. There's no worse feeling in the world, I can assure you. You never want to see your children in any pain, and you certainly don't want to be the source of it. I recovered quickly and reverted to a simple response that I teach all my clients. I said, "Thank you. Daddy will do better." From that moment, I started keeping track of how many days I spent at least 4 hours interacting with my family without TV, movies, football, or the telephone as a distraction. I'm proud to say I got better. The first year, I logged in 92 days of unencumbered interaction with my family. The second year, 110 days. The third year, 131 days. The fourth year, 135 days. 5 years after that first conversation with my daughter, I was spending more time with my family, and my business was more successful than it had been when I was ignoring them. I was beaming with pride, not only with the results, but also with the fact that, like a skilled soft side accountant, I documented them. I was so proud, in fact, that when I went to my kids, both teenagers by this time, and said, "Look, kids, 135 days. What's the target this year?" How about 150 days? Both of them said, "No, Daddy, you have overachieved." My son Brian suggested paring down to 50 days. My daughter Kelly agreed. In the end, both voted for a massive cutback in time with Daddy. I wasn't discouraged by their response. It was as eye-opening as that first conversation with my daughter 5 years earlier. I was so focused on the numbers, on improving my at-home performance each year, that I forgot that my kids had changed too. An objective that made sense when they were 9 years old didn't make sense when they evolved into teenagers. Everything is measurable if we're clever enough to see that it needs measuring and can devise a way to track it. For example, no matter how busy you are or how much you travel for your job, it's easy to measure how many days a year you spend at home. All you have to do is look at the calendar and count. Yet how many of us, especially the spouses and parents among us who feel guilty about our frequent absences from our loved ones, ever think about tracking our days at home? The strange thing is we do this habitually in so many other parts of our lives outside the workplace. Runners training for a race consistently measure how fast they are running and keep a log of the miles they cover each week. Even a casual athlete trying to get in shape will go to the gym and maintain a rough memory that he lifted X amount of weight yesterday, so that 3 weeks later, he would want to lift X weight plus 20%. So why don't we apply the same metrics to goals that really matter? Once you see the beauty of measuring the soft values in your life, other variables kick in, such as the fact that setting numerical targets makes you more likely to achieve them. For example, another measurement I injected into my home life was seeing if I could spend 10 minutes each day engaging my wife and each of my kids in a one-on-one conversation. 10 minutes is not a long time, but it's a significant improvement on zero. I found that if I measured the activity, I was much more likely to do it. If I faltered, I always told myself, well, I get a credit towards the goal, and it only takes me 10 minutes. Maybe I'm tired, but what the hell? I can just go ahead and do it. Without that measurable goal, I was much more likely to blow it off. Rule 7. Monetize the result. Create a solution. The same metrics you apply to yourself to change behavior can be applied to other people, especially if money is part of the equation. For example, when he noticed all the trash talk and vulgarity his children brought home from work, a friend of mine established a swear jar for the family. Every time anyone uttered a profanity, they had to donate a dollar to the jar. The first thing the father noticed after depositing several dollars a day for the first week was how foul-mouthed he was around the children. He learned where they were picking up the bad habit, from him. Monetizing the punishment does that. When you actually have to pay for your mistakes, you notice them more acutely. Unless you like losing money for no reason, you eventually change your ways. Within a month, the vulgarity had vanished. There are all sorts of ways to incentivize people to change their behavior, and I approve of anything that works, from bonuses to fines to gifts to vacations. It's a simple idea, but it's amazing how few people think of attaching a financial reward to ending a problem. I've been coaching executives for 2 decades now, but it was only in 2005 that one of my clients introduced a financial incentive into the process. He was one of the top officers at a West Coast industrial company, a real hard charger whose big issue was not sharing information. The company's CEO assured me that no matter how harsh the feedback and how severe the resistance from employees, I would collect my fee. "This guy will get better," said the CEO. "He would rather die than fail at anything." The CEO was right. The guy was a pleasure to work with because he was so determined to get better. He quickly picked up that neither he nor I was the important constituency in the process. The people who worked with him and for him were. So he did something I'd never seen before. He concluded that the most vital person in the process was his executive assistant. She was the one who saw him day in and day out. She knew his faults best, and she would have the strongest opinions about what he needed to do to get better. She was also in the best position to see if he was mending his ways, as well as remind him when he was backsliding. So he made his